Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Everyone awake and ready?
Yes.
Good. You please pray with me. O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Saints
and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Peace, bliss, amen. Bring a show and tell. We are doing a little cleaning and organizing in the basement, and I came across this. This is something that Swami Satchitananda gave to me for a birthday present for many years ago now, several years ago. Do you think so? It even fits. Isn't that fun? Beautiful handwork. Swamiji's, I think, were the authors of regifting. On his anniversary of 50 years of taking sannyas, which is renunciation of everything in the world, he got all kinds of gifts and things that people kept pouring things into him. It's tough to be a renunciant. Also, in the cleaning out, I came across this little cartoon. I don't know if it's mine or mother's, but it's old and fellow sitting at the desk, and that reminded me of what our government is doing these days. But it says, the husband is looking at the wife and says, "I think we achieved true upper middle class status, Henrietta. We're in debt beyond our wildest dreams." We have a real treasure trove in Paramahansa Yogananda's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And reading from expanded commentary, The Battle of Life. From the moment of conception to the surrender of the last breath, man has to fight in each incarnation innumerable battles, biological, hereditary, bacteriological, physiological, climatic, social, ethical, political, sociological, psychological, metaphysical. So many varieties of inner and outer conflicts. Competing for victory in every encounter are the forces of good and evil. The whole intent of the Gita is to align man's effort with the side of Dharma, or righteousness. The ultimate aim in self-realization, the realization of man's true self, the soul, as made in the image of God, one with the ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss of spirit. The first contest of the soul in each incarnation is with other souls seeking rebirth, with the union of sperm and ovum to begin the formation of a new human body. A flash of light appears in the astral world, the heavenly home of souls between incarnations. That light transmits a pattern which attracts a soul according to that soul's karma, the self-created influences from past actions, from actions of past lives. In each incarnation, Karma works itself out partly through hereditary forces. The soul of the child is attracted into a family in which hereditary is in conformance with the child's past karma. Many souls vie to enter this new cell of life. Only one will be victorious. In the case of multiple conception, more than one primal cell is present. Within the mother's body, the unborn child struggles against disease, darkness, and periodic feelings of limitation and frustration, as the soul consciousness in the unborn child remembers and then gradually forgets its greater freedom of expression during its astral sojourn. The soul within the embryo also has to contend with karma, which is influences for good or ill the formation of the body in which it is now a resident. Additionally, it encounters the vibratory influences that reach from outside. The environment and actions of the mother, external sounds and sensations, vibrations of love and hate, peace and anger. After birth, the struggles of the infant are between its instincts to seek comfort and survival and opposing relative helplessness of the immature bodily instrument. A child begins his first conscious struggle when he has to choose between the desires to play aimlessly and his desire to learn, study, and pursue some course of systematic training. Gradually, more serious battles arise, forced upon him by karmic instincts from within or by bad company and environment from without. It's rather amazing any of us survive all of this, isn't it? It's quite a lot. The youth finds himself confronted suddenly with a host of problems that often he has been ill-prepared to meet. Temptations of sex, greed, prevarication, money-making by easy but questionable means, pressure from the company he keeps, and social influences. The youth usually discovers he possesses no sword of wisdom with which to fight the invading armies of worldly experiences. The adult who lives without cultivating and employing his innate powers of wisdom and spiritual discrimination finds inexorably that the kingdom of his body and mind is being run by the insurgents of misery-making wrong desires, destructive habits, failure, ignorance, disease, and unhappiness. Few men are aware that a state of constant warfare exists in their kingdom. Usually it is only when the devastation is nearly complete that men helplessly realize the sad ruin of their lives. The psychological conflict for health, prosperity, self-control, and wisdom has to be started anew each day in order for man to advance towards victory, reclaiming inch by inch the territories of the soul occupied by the rebels of ignorance. The yogi, the awakening man, is confronted not only with the external battles fought by all men, but also with the internal clash between negative forces of restlessness arising from manas, or the sense consciousness mind, and the positive power of his desire and effort to meditate, supported by buddhi, intelligence, when he tries to reestablish himself in the soul's inner kingdom of spirit. The subtle centers of life and divine consciousness in the spine and brain. The Gita therefore points out, in its very first stanza, the prime necessity to man of nightly introspection, that he may clearly discern which force, the good or the evil, has won the daily battle. To live in harmony with God's plan, man must himself, each night, the ever pertinent question, gather together on this sacred bodily tract, the field of good and evil actions, what did my opposing tendencies do? Which side won the day in the ceaseless struggle? The crooked, tempting, evil tendencies and the opposing forces of self-discipline and discrimination. Come now, tell me, what did they do? The yogi, after each practice of concentrated meditation, asks his power of introspection, assembled in the region of consciousness, in the cerebral spinal axis, and on the field of the body's sensory activity, eager for battle, the mental sense faculties that try to pull the consciousness outward, and the children of the soul's discriminative tendencies that seek to reclaim the inner kingdom, what did they? Who won this day? The ordinary individual, like a skirmish, scarred, beleaguered warrior, is all too conversant with the battles. But often his haphazard training has been wanting in an understanding of the battlefield and of the science behind the attacks of the opposing forces. The knowledge would increase his victories and lessen his bewildered defeats. In the historical telling of the cause of the war of Kurukshetra, the noble sons of Pandu reigned victoriously over their kingdom until King Duryodhana, the wicked reigning son of King of the Blind King Dhritarashtra, cleverly took away from the Pandavas their kingdom and banished them into exile. Symbolically, the kingdom of body and mind rightfully belonged to King Soul and his noble subjects of virtuous tendencies. But King Ego and his kinsmen of wicked and noble tendencies cunningly usurped the throne. When King Soul arises to reclaim his territory, the body and mind become the battleground. How the King Soul rules over his bodily kingdom, loses and then regains it, is the essence of the Gita. As many of you know, I have a birthday coming up. And so I think for many of us, when we have a birthday coming, it makes us reflective, as it should, I think. As Master points out here, the first chapter in the first stanza talks about introspection. Scott Peck, in his book on the nature of evil, pointed out that it was his opinion that those souls who did not have the courage to face themselves, to have this level of introspection, to strive to make the effort to grow spiritually, psychologically, cultivated evil tendencies. And I think, in essence, what he says is true, that this idea of being able to analyze and assess our own lives, the more detached we're able to analyze the things of our life, the events, the words spoken, the consciousness that we reside in, the greater will be our ability to discern what is true from what is untrue, what is correct versus what is incorrect. And it is not until we have the courage to do that that we are able to truly grow. Some lessons that I have learned in this life have revolved around this one central idea. In my own work with as a counselor and as a minister for God, I have worked with many, many individuals, and what I have noticed is that those who make the greatest amount of progress are those who are able to introspect upon their own lives, their own behavior. They have the courage to look at themselves and to be able to assess what is right and what is true. And when they discover what is not right and not true, they change or they work to change that behavior, that attitude, whatever it is that they find is incorrect. Those who stubbornly cling to outmoded ideas will be relegated to repeating themselves, even as those who do not learn from history are sure to repeat history's lessons again and again. And this is the way that things have been designed. We can continue to do the wrong things. We can continue to be guided by ignorance. We have that free will. And there is nothing that can stop us from pursuing that kind of goal. However, when we do, the results will be predictable. In ancient times, many of the scriptures have been written in a way that God is punishing man for this, that, and the other thing. He smotes, he smites him. He sends lightning, perhaps, down from the heavens. He does all kinds of things. He destroys entire communities, and so on. But I think this is not a full and complete description of the law of karma. The law of karma operates like any other physical law that we know from physics. The law of gravity, the law of momentum, these kind of things are well understood because we see the physical evidence of them. And the law of karma is very much the same way. Whatever we set into motion through thought, word, or deed has an equal and opposite reaction upon us. In other words, it goes out and then it comes back to us. There is a saying that the greatest penalty that a habitual liar pays is not that he won't find anybody to believe him. He'll always find people who will be willing to believe him. The biggest price that an habitual liar pays is that they will never trust anyone else because they will always assume that other people are just like they are, that they are lying to them, that they wouldn't be truthful, that they wouldn't be of service, that they wouldn't be selfless. It's beyond their conception. Therefore, they cannot see it for another person. Likewise, for a saint, they look out on the world, and what do they see? They see God. They see everyone trying and striving to do their best. They see the divine life awakening itself in every person and every situation. Now, some circumstances and some people don't apparently be striving for anything other than selfish gain. But the saint realizes, the realized master realizes, that that individual will go out and create through their activity. They will seek their selfish gains, and eventually that will all mount up against them. And it will make their lives very miserable for a time, but it will begin to wake them up. Wake them up to what is really true and right in their lives. None of us can escape this. And therefore, we're all subject to it. Now, how a truly realized master or saint escapes karma, as it's spoken about, is that their lives and their minds are now completely attuned to the divine consciousness. And they have no self-will other than the divine will. That is their sole and complete focus of their mind and of their attention. And when you come to such a purified state of mind, then you realize that there is no benefit to you or to anybody else to ignore the divine will, that whenever you have done it, and however long you have done it, it has a very definite effect upon you, and it's not one that you like. What seems to be freedom initially turns out to be a prison. If you're given credit cards, for instance, and you go out and you begin to spend, like a drunken sailor, so to speak, and you go out and you do this, it can seem like a grand time for a while. But eventually the bill comes due. And unlike in material courts, perhaps, in the karmic court of judgment, there is no claiming bankruptcy. There's no getting around it. You have to pay the bill. And that bill comes due. And then you think that life is being unkind and cruel to you. And it's because you've forgotten all that you've gone out and done and how you've run up the bill. And now you complain and you moan and you groan. But many people, given the second chance, will go out and do exactly the same thing. And they'll go out and they'll spend some more. They don't learn the lesson. They don't get it. They think they can get something for nothing. And it's not possible. It's just not possible. Now, money people, they don't want to hear this. They'd rather think that they can go out and act with impunity. They can do whatever they would like to do, and there's no serious consequences to it. But this is not the truth. This is not dharma. Dharma is, by its very definition, that which is right, that which is uplifting, that which is ennobling. And when you cultivate that, then surely your future will be better. Now, in this lifetime, I didn't know all of these things when I entered into this lifetime. And I didn't know that I was entering into a battlefield. And I didn't like it very much because life didn't always give me exactly what I wanted. I remembered when I was very young and I prayed to God and I said, God, I want lots of friends and good grades. But I didn't want to have to do anything for it. I didn't have to want to work for it. I didn't want to have to make any effort, really. I just wanted it handed it to me. And that prayer really didn't work out in the way that I wanted it to. It continued, life continued to teach me the lesson that if I really want something out of this life, I must enter into this life. Krishna says in the Gita that as long as you breathe, as long as you eat, you are acting in this world. You cannot act as if you are not. And so you must learn to guide yourself with wisdom. And in order to do this, we must pay attention. We must have this level of introspection. Introspection is the way to freedom. Because without it, we project upon this world all the things that we think is wrong with the world is actually a reflection of something that's within us. And without introspection, we don't get it. We don't see our part in this. We don't see how a realized master could be in our exact situation, and find their joy, find peace, find light, find wisdom, find the way through whatever maze of difficulties and obstacles that we have generated for ourselves. We don't realize that a realized master could enter into hell and through their right actions would gradually begin to lift that hellish region into a heavenly region. That we have this creative capacity within us when we attune ourselves to the highest light that we know. We stop blaming this world. We stop blaming the people who are in our lives. We start blaming our situations. We stop finding excuses of why we're not entering into that heavenly kingdom that is to be found right within you. So it is time. It is always time. But we have to let go of our resentment. And this is one of the great things that occurred to me at one point. Was that I was holding on to a resentment. Life should be easier. Life should not be a battle. When I've spoken on this subject before, people will say, well, does it have to be a battle? Can it be something easier? Well, that would be nice. I didn't make the rules up. I just am an observer of them. And the fact is, this is the way that we learn. This is the way that we grow. This is the way that we change. Now, grace is with us. In fact, we would not be able to make these changes at all if there were not a higher power and intelligence that is constantly trying to lift us up, constantly guiding us. However, we must make the effort. There must be effort there. And where there is effort, there is obstacles. And the obstacles come up. And what really determines a realized master is those who have really gotten the lesson. They don't dilly-dally. They don't waste their time. Their minds are always focused upon God. Now, Papa reduces it all down to a prime simplicity. That's absolutely wonderful because it's total truth. He states here in Life in the Divine, or the Divine Life book, and it's Divine Thought. In order to attain the supreme blessedness of life, namely the realization of God, we have to surcharge our thought with the idea of God. God must take possession of our mind until our mind is no longer there as such, and God alone is. Until this is done, the aspirant must employ every means possible to control the mind and its activities so that the thought of God alone should rule in it. This thought must sink deep into the mind, transforming its fickle, restless, and impure nature into the very spirit of joy, purity, and peace. The world is hungering for this great ideal of happiness and peace. Ram Dass' experience when he was flitting from village to village, from town to town in the blessed land of saints, Maharashtra, was, he observed, not only the intensity or keenness of spiritual hunger amongst thousands of people there who came to see him, but he also discovered that many of them, whatever the external circumstances, were drinking deep at the fountain of eternal joy. The chief condition needed for realizing this state is unceasing hunger, or uninterrupted and unbroken aspiration for the immortal. The easiest means to make the mind dwell in the idea of God is to constantly reiterate mentally or vocally the name of God. Such a recitation of the name should, of course, be accompanied by implicit faith in the efficacy of the name and intense love for the immortal idea which the name represents, viz., the supreme reality, who is absolute existence, consciousness, and bliss, or Sat-Chit-Ananda, and who is seated in the hearts of all. When thus the mind is completely absorbed in the divine idea, a stage is reached when the mere individual or physical consciousness is transmuted into the universal and ever-blissful consciousness. What a tremendous idea here. It is the idea that perhaps was birthed originally in India. But it is this idea that we can exist in God consciousness, that Sat-Chit-Ananda, the consciousness, the awareness, the bliss of God, and that we can enter into that, and actually we can be so consumed in it that we become that, and that becomes ourselves. The easiest means to make the mind dwell in the idea of God is to constantly reiterate mentally or vocally the name of God. This is all right. Everybody wishes to possess this hunger, this keen aspiration which will bring him or her the experience of divinity. But the complaint is that such a state does not come even when one wishes for it. How then could this burning desire for the attainment of absolute bliss be generated? Just as an uneducated man or poor man would evince an ardent wish to be a literate man or a rich man when he comes in association with a learned person or a wealthy person, so also when an ignorant, bound, and sorrow-stricken soul comes in contact with an illumined, liberated, and all-blissful person, the former by such contact is fired with a zeal to become also like the latter. Hence, the Society of Saints has been held out as the most important factor in the spiritual evolution of the soul. The saints not only awaken the ignorant soul and create in them a thirst for self-realization, but also infuse into them by their blessings the needed spiritual strength to battle against the forces that confront the aspirant in his march towards the goal of supreme beatitude. And in order to know what are actual facial features, we have to look in the mirror. Similarly, if we wish to get a glimpse of our real and immortal life, we can do so only when we are in the company of saints. Saints are verily the redeemers of fallen souls. It is by their power alone the mind that runs in pursuit of transient pleasures can be made to concentrate its attention upon the eternal, changeless, and blissful indwelling reality. When thus the mind is permeated through and through with the imperishable idea of God, man attains the supreme goal of life. God realization does bring about not only the divinization of the internal life of man, but also all his external life and activities. He beholds all beings and things as the illumined expressions of the one all-pervading divinity. Satsang awakens the human soul and fills his thought with the divine light and joy, and grants him the knowledge of the immortal self, which in its turn confers upon the devotee the comprehensive knowledge of God in all of his aspects. What a powerful, profound statement that Papa makes in such writing. And he realized it. Mother summed it all up by saying, keep your mind on God. To chant God's name, to love God, to meditate upon God, to serve God in everything that you do. These are the things that we are told to do. And if we will deeply accept these ideas, put them into action, then we will enter into a rebirth in our life. Our first birth is into this physical body, but our second birth is into spirit. And when we are able to rebirth ourselves, so to speak, we are born anew. We feel ourselves transformed. We now feel a blissful kind of thrill running throughout our entire being. Our mind is constantly being fed by the divine mind and consciousness. Bliss comes up within ourselves, not from any outer aspect of our lives. It is something that is natural and innate. The consciousness is so purified that it is lifted up and expands and it merges into the infinite consciousness of the divine God. All of these things are possible. All of these things are possible with this kind of rebirth. And if we would but put it into action, then we can prove for ourselves in the laboratory of our own souls the truth of what has been handed down for so many thousands of years. This Bhagavad Gita is said to be 5,000 years old or more. What tremendous truths have been evinced, and so many saints and realized masters have confirmed its truth. Why would we delay even for a moment? So it is a wonderful, blessed privilege to be born into this world. But if we live this life in ignorance and we never regain that eternal kingdom within us, then what will we say about this life? If this is the true purpose for which we come, then we must strive, body, mind, heart, and soul, with all of our strength, to attain this tremendous, blessed experience. And join there all the great spiritual masters who have ever been, because they are merged in that consciousness. And when we merge into that consciousness, we merge into them, and they into us. Can you imagine being intimates with Jesus, with Buddha, with Krishna, with Master, with Mother, with Babaji? Can you imagine having them part and parcel of your being, and you are part and parcel of theirs? And now purity reigns throughout every cell of your body. Now some people imagine that you lose your freedom when you enter into such a stage of consciousness, but this is quite the opposite of what is true. You gain your freedom. But there's a paradox. We gain our freedom through complete and total surrender. We lose our freedom when we willfully act from ignorance. Now, we are free to do so, but we create a debtor's prison that gets more and more and more enclosed. So let us sing God's name, mentally or outwardly.
Let us always keep our mind upon God. Let us serve Him. You know, it's a wonderful thing when you feel that you are serving God in whatever you're doing. Now, the material boss is not your boss, but God is your boss. Now, when you do something, you're not looking for what are you going to get in return, but you feel the joy of service, of giving in the way that you do. There are so many who give in order to help this work, and it's such joy when that gift, that service comes with love and with devotion and with a consciousness of purity, because it imbues the gift itself with that same sense of purity. And can you imagine a world in which we are all serving one another, loving one another, seeing God within one another? All the rules, all the laws, everything could be practically stricken from the books if we abided by that one golden rule, that we do unto others as we would be done by. These are not vain imaginings. These are not daydreams. These are realities, and in some planes of consciousness, they exist right now. And we are here as forerunners. We are here to proclaim that there is a new day. And with that new day will come a new consciousness. And a time when wars and rumors of wars, when conflicts and fights will be something of the past, when we are all guided by divine wisdom. Let us work with everything that is within us. We don't have to be door knockers or bell ringers and going out and trying to convince people that way. The very best advertising you have is by how you guide your life, by the consciousness that you live in. And when you have purified your consciousness, you become a radiant light for the divine consciousness, an advertisement of the very best kind. And you may not say a word, but it radiates through everything you think, say, and do. So let us strive to be a servant for that divine light and find our complete and total freedom. This is, I think, the great lesson of life. And the lesson of life teaches us to live in a spirit of service, to let go of selfish means and selfish ends, and love completely. And when we do this, we will find the joy and the freedom that we really, truly hunger for every day of our lives. So if you join me in prayer, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
To the light within you. May that divine presence ever awaken itself within you and express itself to this world as light, love, and joy, guided by wisdom.